Both Democratic and Republican activists agree. Hillary Clinton won. This hour, picking apart last night's Democratic presidential debate. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Political analysis this hour from Dennis Goldford and Rachel Caulfield of Drake University. We'll ask what they saw in the debate last night among the five contenders on stage in Las Vegas. I'll ask them how it may change the Democratic race. For instance, is this debate likely to end Clinton's late summer tailspin? Also later in the program, Paul Ryan has made it abundantly clear he doesn't want to be the next Speaker of the U.S. House. So what's next for a House in disarray? Join our discussion on this Politics Day. First, this news. It's Politics Wednesday here on River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Joining us in our Des Moines studio, two faculty members in Drake University's Department of Politics and International Relations. Dennis Goldford joins us again. He is also the Flansburg Fellow for the Harkin Institute for Public Policy and Citizen Engagement at Drake University. Rachel Caulfield is with us, Associate Professor of Politics in that department at Drake. Rachel, Dennis, glad you could come in today.
Glad to be here.
And it is a nice day to be in on Politics Day. We have the first Democratic debate, presidential debate to talk about. A little bit later in the hour, we'll talk about a House in disarray, the U.S. House of Representatives in search of a new speaker to succeed John Boehner. But first, let's talk about the Democratic debate. Reaching out to our listeners yesterday, those who saw the debate, were you surprised about anything you saw? What surprised you most? Did anything change your mind? What issues, what differences on issues caught your attention? 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Iowa Public Radio is also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. We want to hear a few excerpts from the debate last night on CNN. But first of all, let me throw this out in looking at what analysts said in the media. Hillary Clinton won by a landslide. That was the headline in a Politico article, Clinton clear winner. According to their assessment of both Democrats and Republicans in this week's political caucus, that's this news site's bipartisan survey of top activists, operatives, and strategists in the leadoff states, including Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, and Nevada. So let's hear your views on the Democratic presidential debate, 2 hours long last night on stage in Las Vegas. Dennis, what is your takeaway? What did you have stand out?
Well, I think given the positions of where the candidates are in the polls, Hillary Clinton had a strong performance. I think the debate did not move the numbers in any meaningful way. In other words, she had a strong position coming in. She managed to maintain that strong position. Bernie Sanders was Bernie Sanders. I mean, he's comfortable with his particular message, and we can talk more about that in a bit. And it was a little sad for the other three candidates. I think they came in as asterisks, and they remained as asterisks.
Mm-hmm. Rachel?
Although I guess I would add, I've heard a number of people say that as a result of the debate, they would like to take a closer look at Martin O'Malley, whether or not this debate performance is going to, you know, allow him to break through at this time in the campaign. I don't know. But certainly, you know, people who are going to his events in Iowa, they've seen him on the campaign trail. This was a chance for him to have national exposure. I think Dennis, on the whole, is absolutely right. What we saw more than anything is the contrasting style of these candidates. They're very different candidates. Even if they agree on a number of issues, there are some points of disagreement, which I think have been well aired at this point. And then you put them on the debate stage and you see very different personalities come out.
Mm-hmm. It was interesting in Clinton's performance, Rachel, don't you think that she made a point to mention her gender a couple of times?
More than a couple of times.
Okay. I wasn't counting.
Yeah, than a couple of times. And I think, you know, she's treading a very fine line here. She's somebody who's been in Washington. She has extensive experience. She wants to rely on that experience. At the same time, this is a year when the voters are clearly looking for some fresh leadership. And so, you know, on more than one occasion, she put forward her gender as a particular marker of how she is an outsider. What about her campaign? What about her presidency would be different?
Certainly lots of interesting issues discussed last night in the debate, asking our listeners as well what issues caught your attention. 1-866-780-9100. Race in there, campaign finance reform, Citizens United tied up in that, domestic surveillance, Wall Street reform, college affordability there, paid family leave, health care, insurance, also Benghazi there. We'll hear that zinger that came out from Bernie Sanders. Perhaps a help, well, to Hillary Clinton. Let's talk about guns here. This was one of the most contentious comments that Hillary Clinton made, aggressive comments, perhaps I should say, during the hour, during the 2 hours. She made these comments when asked if Senator Bernie Sanders had gone far enough with gun control legislation. Let's listen.
Senator Sanders did vote 5 times against the Brady Bill. Since it was passed, more than 2 million prohibited purchases have been prevented. He also did vote, as he said, for this immunity provision. I voted against it. I was in the Senate at the same time. It wasn't that complicated to me. It was pretty straightforward to me that he was going to give immunity to the only industry in America. Everybody else has to be accountable, but not the gun manufacturers. And we need to stand up and say enough of that. We're not going to let it continue.
We're going to bring you all in.
Okay, Hillary Clinton last night. Dennis Goldford, what do you think of that comment?
Well, I think it was very deft. I think that, you know, typically the way the two candidates are portrayed is that Hillary Clinton is really pretty much of a centrist Democrat with ties to Wall Street. And Bernie Sanders is the, as we've talked about before, the Democratic or liberal id. In other words, he embodies the basic passions and desires of liberals for a strong welfare state of the sort we find in Scandinavia, as he mentioned. But the one area where Bernie Sanders is not part of the liberal id is gun control, because as he said, he represents a rural state and has a different constituency to whom he's answerable and accountable, and he's voted their particular views with some sense, of course, of gun control, but not the way Hillary Clinton, with a much more urban kind of constituency, would have.
Mm-hmm. Seth on Facebook agrees with you call it the liberal id. Seth on Facebook says, very impressed by Sanders. He was definitely the most sincere person on stage and seems to be doing the least posturing. Rachel, we evaluate people in a debate, candidates on the stump, but more also on in a debate in terms of their sincerity. And Sanders is always scoring high there, isn't he?
Sanders is always scoring high there. And this gets back to the idea that he is the Democratic Party's id, as Dennis says. He's, you know, he's somebody who clearly he is out there talking about what he believes in. I think last night he could have done a better job explaining the democratic socialism and what those principles entail in his mind, how they would translate into the U.S. governmental system. But having said that, and this is somebody who, you know, by his own admission, he did not intend to be doing this well in the polls. He's as surprised as anybody by his rise. And, you know, he's out there. He's talking about what he believes in. He's obviously got a lot of people interested in what he believes in. And he's got little to lose at this point. He can say things that no one else can.
Right. And juxtapose what we're saying about Bernie Sanders with Hillary Clinton. Did she describe herself last night as a progressive, but a progressive who wants to get things done? So, Dennis, how does that fit in with what you call the Democratic id, Bernie Sanders?
Well, I think Hillary Clinton would claim to be more realistic about the existing nexus of power relations in Washington. I mean, Bernie Sanders' whole program is very idealistic, and it's all about the program, the message. As Rachel said, it's not about Bernie Sanders and his own ambition personally. That's what Hillary Clinton is often accused of, rightly or wrongly. But his whole program is premised on the idea that he will get all sorts of liberals out there in the political environment who have not come to the polls in recent years because there's nobody to vote for. He will get them to come out to vote and sweep to power and effect all these fundamental changes he's talking about. In that sense, he's the liberal Democratic version of Ted Cruz on the Republican side, who's saying the same thing about conservatives. And Hillary Clinton has worked more in the context of existing power relations. And I think that comment that you quoted is her orientation towards saying, basically, I've got to work with the system as it is.
Mm-hmm. And you heard from several candidates in various forms last night, you know, some veiled or unveiled critique of Bernie Sanders, which was basically, you know, look, Bernie Sanders may have great ideas, but it's not going to happen. Let's be more realistic about the political system that we have.
Bernie Sanders says it will happen if enough people go to the polls. We have a miserable participation in our elections.
That's right. The question is, of course, is there this great liberal majority out there? That's what Democrats, going back to Howard Dean, have said. And Republicans since 2008 have been saying they lose elections because they're not conservative enough, because there's a great conservative majority out there that don't come to the polls. My view is they both forget their James Madison, who argues there is no permanent majority out there in the landscape at all. You've got to assemble a coalition of various different groups in order to have a national electoral majority.
We have Dennis Goldford and Rachel Caulfield with us of Drake University. What was your take on yesterday's first Democratic presidential debate, 1-866-780-9100, a debate not only Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, also Martin O'Malley, Lincoln Chafee, and Jim Webb. Kimberly in Ames, what stood out for you?
You know, I was an undecided voter last night, and I think that what really kind of brought me to going to be supporting O'Malley is that, and I think it's kind of getting left out, is his accomplishment as a mayor, as a governor. And kind of what Rachel said about Sanders, it's a lot of ideas and telling people what they want to hear, but no clear way of getting that done. You know, the $15 an hour minimum wage, yeah, of course that, you know, people want that, but I'd rather have someone tell me how they got to 10-10 an hour minimum wage in their state. You know, when compare and contrast Bernie and O'Malley's records with guns, I know that Bernie comes from, you know, Vermont, a very, you know, pro-gun state, but there's also parts of Eastern Maryland where the governor pointed out that he was, you know, was able to reach out and get those on board. So we're seeing two different candidates there, and I think O'Malley kind of might be getting not as much credit as he deserves, because I think that he has, more I learn about him, a strong record.
Okay, Kimberly and Ames, thank you for your view. 1-866-780-9100. Was it Dennis or Rachel beforehand? Mentioned Martin O'Malley didn't have a bad evening.
Yeah, that was me. I think he did pretty well. And you know, in Iowa, we have a lot of people who actually get to see these candidates, and so while national pundits may not be paying any attention to Martin O'Malley, particularly among young voters, I'm finding a lot of people who are really impressed with him on the campaign trail. They were waiting to see a strong performance from him last night, and I think they did. Nationally, we're not going to have a lot of people talking about his performance. And in, you know, since the debate, we haven't had a lot of national pundits mention his performance last night. But for those who are clued in the early states, I think there's some possibility for movement by Martin O'Malley.
The question is, if you think of the candidates of having a niche or a lane, what is O'Malley's lane? That's the problem. What's distinctive about him? Yes, he's been a governor and a mayor. On the other hand, when he left the governor's office there, the subsequent election was taken to be a referendum on his stewardship of the state. And Maryland, which is a very Democratic state, elected a Republican. Mm-hmm. And that was taken as a rebuke to O'Malley. And so that doesn't count very much in his favor on the part of a lot of people.
And I guess I would add two things, not to kind of – I think in my mind, I'm just suggesting that I think that there might be – room for movement in O'Malley's poll numbers in a way that perhaps there is not right now for Hillary Rodham Clinton or for Bernie Sanders. And, you know, when we look at bringing new people into the system, we look at undecided voters. I think more and more of them are looking at O'Malley. O'Malley's trying to create a lane for himself by talking about his executive experience and by talking about the fact that he's actually been on the cutting edge of some of these quote-unquote liberal issues, including marriage equality and the minimum wage, gun control. And so, you know, whether or not those messages ultimately will resonate in time for him to make movement, we don't know. But I think he had a good performance last night.
I don't think he can take it away from Hillary Clinton. But if her candidacy weakens or implodes, that's the best that O'Malley can hope for.
Okay. Let's talk about the moment from last night, which has gotten the most play in the media, at least. Of course, the email controversy dogging Hillary Clinton now for months, many say contributing to her late summer tailspin, a little bit of a tailspin in the polls. Here's what Bernie Sanders had to say about it last night, and Hillary Clinton joyful about it.
Let me say something that may not be great politics, but I think the secretary is right. And that is that the American people are sick and tired of hearing about your damn emails.
Thank you. Me too.
You know, the middle class, Anderson. And let me say something about the media as well. I go around the country, talk to a whole lot of people. Middle class of this country is collapsing. We have 27 million people living in poverty. We have massive wealth and income inequality. Our trade policies have cost us millions of decent jobs. The American people want to know whether we're going to have a democracy or an oligarchy as a result of Citizens United. Enough of the emails. Let's talk about the real issues facing America.
There's the passion of Bernie Sanders last night. Hillary Clinton, not unhappy about that. But I wonder, Rachel, by saying... early in the night, early in this debate, that Americans are tired of the controversy surrounding Clinton's use of a private email account, because that's the Democratic reading. Of course, they would like Americans to be tired of it. If they are, I don't know. Did Sanders, though, essentially neutralize Hillary's biggest weakness in bringing this out?
Well, you know, first of all, you love the candid moments on the debate stage, and this was one of them, and it was clearly a big crowd pleaser. Among the Democratic base, the email controversy should be put to bed. It's over. It's done. It doesn't matter. But in this case, it's preaching to the choir. Not a lot of Republicans heard Bernie Sanders last night and said, oh, OK, we should stop investigating this. Let's not pay any more attention to the emails. Nobody cares. So, you know, it's red meat for the Democratic base.
OK, let me ask it this way then. Going forward, does this mark a pivotal moment? Will her campaign, Dennis, do you think, be able to shape the narrative to issues rather than always answering the email controversy and the drip, drip, drip of the new emails being looked at by the investigation?
She testifies before a House committee in a week.
Yep.
And all the focus will be building on that. And so that was a very interesting moment last night. Sanders was not playing Machiavelli politician. He was, in a very idealistic or naive way, playing to his message and not attacking her. But as Rachel said, the Republicans are still out there sharpening knives, and she has to sit and address the committee next week. That will be more determinative.
Okay. We're going to join our discussion. Discussing at the moment the first Democratic presidential debate last night, Susan is with us in Grinnell. Hi, Susan. Or is it Suzanne?
Yes.
Is it Suzanne?
Yes, thank you. I was somebody just said that on this program that in order to win, you need to get a coalition together. And I have been a little confused why Bernie has gotten, seems like, reservation or pushback or something from Hispanics and black voters. And I wondered what the people on this show today think of his answers and whether or not that's going to cause those voting groups to feel more positive about his candidacy.
Dennis, Rachel?
I was the one that made that comment. If you look at liberal politics today, and they've been that way for quite some time, a lot of it has had to do with what we call identity politics. And the three central categories in identity politics, Republicans have their own version of that, whether they realize it or not, on the Democratic side would be race, gender, class. And Bernie Sanders' message going back for decades is all about class. It's not about race or gender. He just doesn't talk in those terms. He talks in terms of working people as opposed to people who live off their stock options and investments. That's part of what makes him a democratic socialist. And so I think the language of race and gender is still somewhat awkward and uncomfortable for Bernie Sanders. He's trying to learn that language. He spoke to that to some extent last night, but he's still trying to work through that. And he ran into trouble early on with the Black Lives Matter issue. He's becoming more adept at it, but he doesn't have that sense of those issues and that support that Hillary Clinton does at this point.
He was asked last night – let's listen to a comment from Bernie Sanders. Last night, because we have entering this election cycle someone who describes himself as a democratic socialist, and we don't know what to make of that. Many people, when I say we, let's listen to what Sanders said when he was asked last night if he was a capitalist.
Do I consider myself part of the casino capitalist process by which so few have so much and so many have so little, by which Wall Street's greed and recklessness wreck this economy? No, I don't. I believe in a society where all people do well, not just a handful of billionaires.
So what do you think, Rachel? Can he sell this once he explains what he means by democratic socialist?
Well, this is one of those difficult situations where you have a term, socialism, that is not well understood and is frequently used in a derogatory way in our political discourse. And yet, for somebody who truly believes in democratic socialist principles, it is a useful term to describe who you are, if that's where you are on the political spectrum. So what Sanders needs to do is translate the word socialism into real policy positions that make sense to voters.
Mm-hmm. And he did this by naming Denmark. Was that a good strategy?
Again.
Other Nordic countries. Country of 6 million people.
Yeah. Again, we're talking about, you know, a core Democratic constituency here for whom Bernie Sanders is very attractive all around.
He's not talking about state ownership of the means of production. In that traditional sense of socialism. But what he's referring to when he talks about Scandinavia is a much stronger social safety net, a much stronger welfare state, and a concern with the unequal, whether it's fair or not, in his view it's unfair, distribution of wealth and income, and talks about those as harmful to democracy itself.
Okay, let's go back to our phones. 1-866-780-9100. Jim is with us in Dubuque. What did you think of last night's debate, Jim?
Well, I was interested in the beginning of your segment here. You said activists were saying that Hillary had won. But when the debate was over, I went on CNN's website and participated in a poll there where Bernie was at 75 or 80% winning and Hillary was at 10% or less, along with the rest of them.
Just to clarify, I was referring to a political poll of activists, operatives, and strategists in lead-off states. So it was quite a different poll than yours. But we've got to take a different break. Ask your question quickly, and we can get back to it on the break and after the break.
Well, I think that you mentioned her statement on gun companies not being liable, and I think that was very misleading or dishonest. The gun companies have been sued for any defects in their products, but they are not sued for people's misuse of them. Like if you couldn't sue a Chevrolet company if somebody decided to use their car to murder somebody.
Jim, we have to go to break. Sorry to cut you off. 1-866-780-9100. Back in just a moment. We're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, Politics Wednesday, with Dennis Goldford and Rachel Caulfield of Drake University are giving us some political analysis about last night's two-hour-long CNN debate on stage in Las Vegas. Lincoln Chafee, Jim Webb, Martin O'Malley, Bernie Sanders, and frontrunner Hillary Clinton there. We're fielding your questions, your comments about what you saw or heard that changed your mind. What caught your attention? 1-866-780-9100. This coming in, I think, on Facebook. Yes, from Facebook. I think Bernie's popularity is that he's actually talking about big issues such as poverty and education. At the same time, he isn't concentrating on sound bites and jabs. I find it interesting that pundits and experts feel Hillary won by a landslide. When the internet is abuzz, it seems to say that Sanders had a walk-off home run. Is this a case of the professionals seeing what they want to see? Thank you, Matt in Boone from Facebook. Dennis Goldford, it seems that the characterization of what's going on in the internet is different than what pundits see.
Well, except the internet is not representative of the population or the electorate as a whole.
I would note pundits aren't either.
That's right. It's much younger. It skews much younger. The situation for Bernie Sanders is not unlike that, and pardon the comparison, of Ron Paul in 2012. He has a floor below which he's not likely to drop. Strong, avid supporters. I have a nephew who's just crazy about Bernie Sanders. But he's got a ceiling as well. And Ron Paul couldn't get above his relatively low ceiling, and the question is whether Bernie Sanders can raise the roof and get above his current ceiling. What we see, at least I'll speak for myself, what I saw last night was nothing that indicated that Sanders last night raised his particular ceiling. Mm-hmm. That may come, but I haven't seen it yet.
Did you see anything in this debate that changed your thinking, Dennis? And I want to ask you too, Rachel, thinking about how this Democratic race is developing?
Well, what was particularly interesting, and I can't recall if I've mentioned this before, is there was no obvious gap or hole on stage due to the absence of Joe Biden. I don't see a particular place for him to come in at this point unless the Clinton campaign does weaken or implode.
So that was – he got – okay, we're thinking in political terms that this would have been a test, perhaps scaring Joe Biden off.
Well, Hillary Clinton, I think, succeeded in comforting some of her supporters. She's not a naturally gifted candidate. She's not a natural politician. So she still has her various flaws, but she delivered a fairly dominant, self-confident, self-assured performance that at least may put some of her supporters a little more at ease than they've been lately and suggest to potential Biden supporters that she's not about to crack, at least yet.
1-866-780-9100. Plenty of people to go to on the phones. Let's get to some of them. Jack is in Waterloo. Hi, Jack.
Hi, how are you? I'm happy to be a former student of both professors present today.
Well, hello.
Hi, Jack.
Hi. I had a question about foreign policy and the role of the debate last night. It seems that Republicans offer, whether it be prudent or not, they offer a decisive position on foreign policy. And I thought in the debate last night we lacked a clear vision of foreign policy that seems to respond or juxtapose well to the Republican Party. I didn't know if the professors could comment on that.
Mm-hmm. Last night we saw, discussion about how to handle Russian intervention in Syria, and Clinton there taking an opportunity to demonstrate her experience as Secretary of State. What is your reaction there, Dennis, Rachel?
Well, Sanders has no real foreign policy experience. I mean, he said, the Veterans Affairs Committee, and that deals with veterans, which is a very important group, an honored group in our political culture. But it's not dealing with foreign policy per se. Clinton was able to call upon her experience as Secretary of State, arguing she helped make tough decisions, and she clearly sounded more hawkish than Bernie Sanders. The hardliner, of course, was Jim Webb, although he went on this rant about China that just seemed a bit of a sideshow when he did it. But this was, I think, more fundamentally a domestic affairs debate.
I would agree completely with that. And we didn't see a lot of discussion about foreign affairs to the extent that it came up. I think, it was used in some cases as a way Jim Webb clearly wanted to use it as a way to assert himself as having a unique experience and bringing something to the job that the other candidates wouldn't have. And then I think, Hillary Clinton to some extent tried to push back on Bernie Sanders and say, look, you've been saying – that we shouldn't be taking military action, let me tell you what my position is. And so put him on the defensive a little bit. He seemed a little bit rattled with that question when he finally came out and said, look, I'm not a pacifist. And then Martin O'Malley was asked to defend him to speak to his campaign stump speech, saying that Hillary Clinton is quick to take military action. So he was trying to assert himself on that position as well. But on the whole, they were arguing foreign policy around the edges.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I would just add that if I were Hillary Clinton, I would take that picture. I believe it was the Situation Room, focused on the president, but she's right there with him waiting for the results of the raid to get Osama bin Laden. I would take that picture and paste it everywhere for her foreign policy credentials.
Okay. Jack in Waterloo, thank you for joining us. We want to switch over to talk a little bit about what's happening in the House, the disarray there. But let's do that in just a couple of minutes, a call or two more. Samson in Oskaloosa, briefly, please. What is your observation or question about last night's debate?
Hi there, guys. It's a pleasure to be on, first of all.
Pleasure to have you.
All right. Thank you. What I wanted to get to was the fact that Bernie Sanders is doing what I've really never seen before in candidates, and it really speaks to me as a college student. He's going to every single college that he can and that reaches out to him and wants to talk to what the young voters and young people who could become voters, what matters to them. And he's straight up honest with it. And I haven't seen any change in anything that he has said in the past. And, you know, it really is hard to imagine any other candidate that really puts forth as much effort as he does and will to put that much effort. And, you know, as a college student, you know, it's hard to not appreciate that and hard to not see that there is a change that can happen and will happen if young people are wanting to go out and vote.
Samson, thank you very much for your comment from Oskaloosa.
If I can go back to, sure, Dennis's comment a little bit earlier about the similarities between Bernie Sanders and Ron Paul. I think this is one of the similarities that I see. You know, millennial voters tend to be pretty cynical about the political process. They have a higher number of independents. They're less tied to formal institutions, and they notoriously are less likely to vote. I think, you know, when Ron Paul really made a splash, it was largely because there were a group of young voters who saw him and they were idealistic and they saw him as being true to his principles. I often said that I think Ron Paul was attractive because he was kind of the anti-politician. He wasn't slick. He wasn't polished. He didn't have talking points. He went to college campuses. He encountered young voters and spoke from his heart in a very principled way. And that was their perception. And it was a totally new kind of campaign that really attracted a lot of new voters. And I think in the same way, Bernie Sanders is an anti-politician. He is not polished. He to say the least.
He's emphatic. He's passionate.
Yeah, he's emphatic. He's passionate. And what people see is somebody who authentically sticks to his principles in the same way that they did with Ron Paul.
Let me quickly advertise my advanced age by saying this is Get Clean for Gene 50 mm-hmm. years on. Gene McCarthy.
That's right.
The same sort of idealism that we saw in 1968.
Hmm. Interesting. David, in Pottawatomie County, you saw the debate. What it comes to your mind? What do you think?
Well, they didn't talk about the post office. They didn't really talk about labor, except giving everybody a raise to $15 an hour if you weren't making it, and everything's going to be free. And the whole thing's just sort of silly in my mind. They just sort of want to take over and I don't know. It's just sort of.
Are you in the Democratic Party? Will you be participating on the Democratic side in the caucuses?
No.
Okay. So you're watching this as a Republican.
Mm-hmm. I used to be a Democrat, and I gave up on them a long time ago.
Mm-hmm. What did you find of interest last night? You watched it. You must have had some interest.
Oh yeah, I like to watch those types of things. I do like Bernie Sanders on. I don't know. He's sort of wild, but I do like his style. He's I think he tells the truth.
Okay.
I don't think Hillary is even close to that.
All right. David in Pottawatomie County, thank you. Quickly, before we move on, compare this, Rachel and Dennis, to the two GOP debates we've had. Five Democrats on the stage, looking a little empty there with just five compared to the Republicans, a total of 15 candidates in two separate events. We had topics. I listed the topics of the Democrats, the GOP issues, some of them including taxes, restricting abortion access, illegal immigration, vaccine skepticism. What are your thoughts when you compare the two debates?
Well, the size of the field clearly makes a big difference. So last night, I think you saw the candidates engage each other much more. You saw much more back and forth on the issues. And Anderson Cooper could kind of moderate their interactions with each other in a way that we haven't seen in the Republican debates thus far. Although I will say, at the last Republican debate, the CNN debate, the pre-debate group was five people, and it was a much more substantive, interactive format than the main stage, if you will. So I think in that respect, it was a very different environment than we've seen on the Republican side so far.
The Democrats hold a dinner party. The Republicans hold a food fight.
Well put. Dennis, let's talk a little bit about what's going on in the U.S. House, a House in disarray since the expected frontrunner, House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy, stunned Washington last week, announced he would drop out of the race. Major Republican Party figures have virtually been begging Wisconsin Congressman Paul Ryan to step up and take this position, citing Ryan's potential ability to unify this fractured Republican caucus.
I'm not sure you can even say they've been virtually begging him. I think they're begging him.
They've been begging him outright. On hands and knees.
That's right.
Paul Ryan making it abundantly clear, at least so far, he does not want to be Speaker of the House. So your thoughts on this, Rachel, will he or won't he? We've got our elected officials away from Washington this week. So I guess the 20th next week will be the first time we will hear news about this, unless there are surprises. Rachel, what do you think? Will Paul Ryan take this?
Well, I think he's absolutely not inclined to take this, and for good reason. First of all, you know, he's a young, dynamic guy who I think has a pretty bright political future in front of him. Given where the party is right now in the U.S. House of Representatives, this is a thankless job. And there's really no way around that. You have a party that's fractured. And you have deep, you know, those fractures are not just surface fractures. Those are deep, deep entrenched divisions. And this is a guy who I think wants to be president someday. Mm-hmm. You don't walk into the speakership and try to negotiate a fractured party.
What if, just thinking out loud here, what if mm-hmm. there were an agreement? He's in a way, in a position of power, being begged to. What if he were the true consensus choice of the party, meaning he had an agreement? No opposition, no sniping, no caving to demands in exchange for support. How possible? How likely is that, Dennis?
Well, he's dealing with the overall Republican conference that contains about, best guess, 40 members. Who would reduce the rest of them to less than a majority of the House, who call themselves the Freedom Caucus, who are not inclined much to consensus and compromise. Indeed, I don't know how many people they represent, but I've seen some conservative-leaning websites who have already suggested that Paul Ryan is too liberal.
Absolutely.
And Paul Ryan was considered much more conservative than Mitt Romney, but these folks consider him too liberal. You have a political party in disarray because they can't seem to figure out how to act as a political party, which involves compromise and consensus. The hardline conservatives actually, as David Brooks' column in the New York Times talks about, are radicals. They are not conservatives with a respect for institutions, institutional procedures, compromise, and dialogue with your opponents. They're bomb throwers, rhetorically speaking. And so that's partly, as Rachel said, this would be a trap for Paul Ryan because it's a no-win situation. And here's a guy who wants to be president. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean he won't take it with sufficient pressure, but I'm sure he doesn't want to take it, as Rachel said.
And I think I would add one other thing. And that is, you know, we look at this setting and we say, gosh, this is crisis scenario. Our politics have gotten so terrible. How did we get to this point? But, you know, there's an ebb and a flow to politics in the U.S. House and institutional dynamics in the chamber. And if you go back to the early 1970s and particularly after Watergate, you saw an influx of fairly compared to the Democrats who had been in control of the House of Representatives for at that point, decades. You had this influx after Watergate of Northern liberal Democrats. And they were the flamethrowers of their time, and they didn't like the party leadership, and they revolted against the party leadership, and it resulted in a new set of rules in the U.S. House of Representatives that dispersed power across members in a much more small D democratic way, and that's had long lasting effects. But we have a cycle of concentrating power in the leadership positions and then dispersing power, and then concentrating power in leadership positions and then dispersing power. So this is not a new dynamic in the House of Representatives. Right now, we have a group of young Republicans who are far more conservative in their outlook than their elders in the House of Representatives are.
Do we have any of those representatives here in Iowa?
I saw one particular website that listed supposedly, it may have been on Vox.com, where Freedom Caucus people come from. They sort of silent as to their exact numbers and membership. But I think this particular website listed Rod Blum from the Iowa First District as a member. It did not list David Young. I can't recall. For some reason, it didn't seem to show Steve King. But if anybody would fit in with them, it would be Steve King, I would think.
Mm-hmm. So what do you see happening next? Paul Ryan taking it, Paul Ryan not taking it, if that made a difference. What are the possible scenarios going forward for the House?
Well, somebody's got to take it. One of the things that's interesting to me as well here is that the individual that the Freedom Caucus has identified as their preferred speaker is Daniel Webster out of Florida.
He's a cipher, basically.
Yeah, but I mean, what's interesting is that he was elected in 2010. He's a junior member. So this really is in many ways a battle between kind of the new conservative guard in the House of Representatives and the older, more established,
I can't remember in recent memory. Perhaps you can recall this, but this is a case where the GOP had nowhere to spin this other than we are not functioning.
That's right.
We are dysfunctional. This is a standout because usually you have to read through the spin, right? There's always a positive spin no matter how bad it is for your
party.
Yeah,
there's no spin here.
We had this at the presidential level in 2012, and we have it even more now, not just presidential but congressional level. And I've mentioned this before, the old Will Rogers line, are you a member of a political party? I'm not a member of any organized political party. I'm a Democrat. But this has now flipped and become the Republican instance of that. The Democrats are acting like Republicans, fairly orderly and respectfully. The Republicans are in the perpetual food fight now, not just at the presidential level, but at the House level, the congressional level.
Okay, so here's the question as we end up with a couple minutes left of our discussion. GOP candidates at all levels, representatives, senators, ran in the last election promising they would make Congress less dysfunctional if it were in Republican hands. So what does this current disarray mean in the midst of a presidential election cycle culminating in a general election in just over a year?
I suspect that it means that we will once again have an unproductive Congress. And I think there will be an expectation to kind of regroup with a new president coming into office to figure out where we go from here. And the party will need to examine as well. There's one Speaker of the House candidate who has not formally declared candidacy, but has been mentioned on a few lists, and that's John Klein out of Minnesota. And he's retiring in 2016, so he's seen as a short-term solution to the current situation.
Dennis, Republican candidates at all levels, incumbents, do they have a leg to stand on with that argument? We'll make government work again?
Well, they've not impressed people, but the problem is they represent, I think, a lot of the divisions among the American people. And we don't elect our Congresses on a nationwide basis. We elect them in the Senate state by state. We elect them in the House district by district. And Republicans there, because the districts have become so strongly one party, Democratic or one party Republican, they're never worried about compromise dealing with people on the other side, because if they're in Congress, they've been elected overwhelmingly by people on one side. And so Republicans are always worried not about Democratic competition, which would cause them to compromise more. They're worried about being primaried from the right by other Republicans, Tea Party and otherwise. And that holds them out to that more uncompromising extreme position. At this point, I don't see that fever breaking yet.
Mm-hmm. As we close here, looking forward to the next week, the big political events, Hillary Clinton's testimony about her emails.
That's where all the attention will be, as we're seeing. We'll see how much leg, what kind of legs that issue has after that testimony.
Okay, I want to thank you very much for joining us this hour. Dennis Goldford, professor of politics in the Department of Politics and International Relations at Drake University, Flansburg Fellow for the Harkin Institute for Public Policy and Citizen Engagement at Drake as well. Rachel Caulfield, associate professor of politics in that department as well at Drake University. Rachel and Dennis, you make a good team. Thank you for giving us your perspectives.
We're willing to take it on the road if
That's
people call.
That's right.
All right. Dennis, now you get off to some food fight because it seems like you want one.
Well, I guess I keep mentioning that.
You do. It is lunchtime.
All right. There you go.
Okay, tomorrow on this program, how has Iowa's climate changed over the past quarter century in terms of temperature, flooding, and drought? What's in store for us in the next quarter century? We'll hear from scientists Jerry Schnur and Greg Carmichael tomorrow on the program. Hope you'll join us. River to River is produced by Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.